Fangoria turns 40 this year, and issue number 2 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fango's also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is available wherever you download music now. And Fango's book line continues. Joining Preston Fasal's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Totally relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order now. Head over to Fangoria.com to learn more about it and to subscribe. Subscribe today to get issue 3, shipping in April, and $60 gets you a full year subscription and saves you $20 off the cover price at Fangoria.com.
This episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Look, if you open my t-shirt drawer now, a large percentage of tees comes from them. Rob, I'm sure you agree with this.
My sock drawer is overflowing with Fright Rags.
They're my number one source for horror t-shirts. They're your number one source for horror t-shirts with specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists. They offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. This week, I just got my Ghostface tee that's in the style of the old t-shirts that you found advertised in Fangoria. I thought that was pretty cool.
Got that for my girlfriend.
Yeah. So what's on tap now for Fright Rags? They just launched a Predator t-shirt and pin collection. Also available, knit horror beanies featuring Trick or Treat, Krampus, Predator, Night of the Living Dead, and the cast and crew beanie that we gave to our cast and crew on the new Halloween film. Coming next Tuesday, January 29th, all new t-shirts for Poltergeist. Poltergeist 2, fellas. Sorry, Elric Rob, no Poltergeist 3.
What?
But Amityville Horror. You don't want to miss out on those. Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WINTERSHOCK10. Again, that's WINTERSHOCK10 at checkout. Again, 10% off. Go shopping. Tell them we sent you.
If you want to sell some t-shirts, I want Amityville 2 and Poltergeist 3. Okay? That's all I want.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 130 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm recovering. I don't know if it was Elric.
Oh.
Elric
Kane
to my left. I've been hit down with the cold.
I don't think I had it last time. I think it was Becca last.
You or Becca or my coworkers.
I think everyone's getting something.
Everyone's getting something.
Not it.
But Ryan Turek is here as well. He is not it.
Not getting sick, guys.
I did have something I wanted to say to a listener.
One of our
best listeners. Tony Collette, I'm sorry and we're here for you. Just know that. All right, Tony? Hereditary, you deserve better.
Oh, I see.
You deserve better.
Because she didn't get nominated for an Oscar?
Yeah. Not that there was any really great nomination this year. I don't know. The whole thing just seemed like blah. But to me, great performance. But we do have even more important.
Yes.
Chainsaw Awards?
Fangoria Chainsaw Awards.
There
we go. So make sure that's where you really can be counted.
Uh-huh.
And there are some really good stuff nominated. I nice, diverse slate. I've dug it.
Yep.
So I haven't looked deep enough.
I already voted. I'm on top of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, speaking of supporting, don't forget you guys can leave reviews and a star rating on iTunes now. Don't forget to leave a few comments.
It helps.
We love feedback. It helps put Shockwaves out there further in the algorithm
of
the great iTunes space.
And that's why Becca isn't here tonight. She's at home writing an iTunes review for us under a pseudonym that you'll never know. And she's probably going to give us 3 out of 5 stars, which is just the Becca way.
Wow.
So what can you do?
Becca sick tonight.
Yeah.
Sicka.
I feel bad because she was most excited about our guest.
Yes.
And so Becca, I will try to set you up to have coffee with our guest at some point because it's not fair that you're not here.
Well, Phil Blankenship might be the most excited about our guest.
Oh, really?
Well, because he's the one organizing
and by the way,
the screening of her.
Phil, we did this specifically
I wrote him.
Because we'll get there. Yeah. Not only do we want to encourage Los Angeles to go, and I think most of us will be there. We want to encourage people in other states and countries to do this triple feature as well in honor of our guests. So we're going to get there. But let's do a couple of quick plugs off the top. This is going to be relevant to one of our episodes coming up, but there is a new documentary that's going to be on Shudder called Horror Noir. And it is an examination. It's a history of black history and horror.
Yep.
And we have gotten an advanced look at the stock. Or at least Ryan and I have. Okay. I don't know if Elric, I don't know if you watch these advanced things that get sent to you.
I usually just wait till just before we do the show.
Sure.
But this one, I mean, as a topic, this is like something.
Oh, it's like, I got a math test tomorrow. I'm going to wait 5 minutes beforehand to cram it.
Sounds like an Elric rolled. Yeah. But I got to tell you, Horror Noir is one of my favorite documentaries that I've seen in quite a while. Mm. It is excellent, excellent, excellent. And I mean, really, you know, you have to kind of. I think Get Out was really responsible for making this conversation happen now. And what I love about it is they do go through the history of black horror, but the way they do it is they pair specific people in theaters talking about the same thing. So to me, I have never felt more joy than seeing Ken Foray and Keith David together in a movie theater talking about black history and horror.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So there's pairs of directors, actors, people like that, that are seeing scenes from movies and then kind of talking about it. So this is just exceptional, and it's going to be if you're a Shudder subscriber, it's going to be exclusively on Shudder as of February 7th. If you're in Los Angeles, they're showing it at the Egyptian on February 1st, and if you're in New York, they're showing it at BAM February 4th. So again, we're going to have a guest tied into this when it premieres. But I just got to tell you in advance how much I love this thing, and I really think everyone should watch it because the conversation is still there. There's still so much to tap from. I mean, we always talk about how many episodes we've done, and it's like, are we ever going to run out of stuff? And there's always different avenues and different perspectives and different people to talk to about the horror genre, and that's what's beautiful about it. So this documentary, Horror Noir, is for you guys.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but it's exciting because I remember we were talking recently on the history of horror where they were talking about how Dwayne Jones wasn't cast in Night of the Living Dead as a black character. He just happened to be the best for the
role.
He
was the best actor.
So what's fascinating to me about that as a whole alternate dimension where if everyone was that open-minded in their casting, just think about the horror films we've watched in our lifetime, how different they would be with certain casting choices. An average film could suddenly be a really interesting film because it's animated by a choice like that.
Sure.
Lethal Weapon had a very similar story behind it with the Danny Glover role. But I think that to me is the part that's so interesting. It's like, oh yeah, casting is such a big part of movies.
Sure. And I mean, you know what's fun about that specific example is like I've never I recognize the importance of Dwayne Jones in Night of the Living Dead. I think he's terrific. I love that character, and I've grown up loving that movie because of it, and I never thought anything of it. But hearing from someone that's black that grew up with that, their perspective is amazing. Yeah. I mean, somebody like Tony Todd who recognized that and then got to play that character in the remake. You know, there's so many – I mean, there's fun – I don't want to give away too much, but like there's – I think it's in the opening scene where there's two directors. One of them is Ernest Dickerson and Rusty, the director of Tales of the Hood.
Oh, yeah.
And they're watching the opening scene of Get Out, and they both just look at each other like, been there, man. And so like right away it's like, oh, man, I love this. Yeah. This is so cool.
Now, was this produced by Fango?
I don't think it was.
I know Phil had signed it, right?
Phil was one of the producers, but I don't think it was a Fangoria produced movie. I think it's just a lot of the Fango team was involved in making it. Yeah,
cool.
Behind the scenes.
No, it's a Shudder original.
Okay,
thing,
cool.
From
my
understanding.
So get ready for that in February. And we just had to mention it. Also, let's talk about Dark Delicacies. Mm-hmm. Dark Delicacies, for a lot of people that listen know, is a bookstore here in Burbank, and it's one of our favorite spots. It's run by Del Howenson and his wife, Sue. They're friends of ours. They do great events. And a couple of months ago, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but my dear friend Andrew Cash and myself and Jim Koons put together a video called Save Magnolia Park. You could just search it on YouTube or even search it on Facebook and you'll find it. And basically the video was bringing attention to the fact that there's this great strip on Magnolia Boulevard of stores, including Dark Delicacies, including Blast from the Past, where horror trivia happens, including the Mystic Museum, where Ryan hosts Slashback Video. Yeah. And
you had Creature Features back then.
Creature Features, which is now gone.
Recently, yeah.
But yeah, basically, it's this great, hip, fun horror destination a lot of people go to. And the landlords and people that kind of own that area recognize it. And they have, and we're not talking just raise the rent a little. We're talking like double, triple what you would pay for a space there. And so we were trying to warn people of it with that video a few months ago. And now Dell and Sue are being forced out of their space just shy of their 25th anniversary, which is horrible. Yeah. But the good news, the silver lining, They wouldn't have done this had they not found the spot. They found a perfect spot right around the block on Hollywood Way. It's going to cost a lot to move, and so they set up a GoFundMe. Thankfully, the generosity of everybody, we've already surpassed their goal, which is great.
Guillermo was a big part of that, I
Guillermo
guess.
Guillermo del Toro.
James Wan.
James Wan kicked in a lot, and I thought that was really cool. Yeah. So a lot of people have been getting behind, including us. I kicked in a bunch, too. They've done so much
stuff
for
in
us.
For the auction I figured would go for a good price.
100%. They're going to do an auction in the beginning of February, so check their page. But please keep supporting it. Even though we've hit their initial goal, it is going to be hard to move that entire store over. And basically the space that they're moving into was not a store. Mm. They basically have to do a lot of construction on it to make it a store. Yeah. I think it was like a karate dojo or something like that.
Yeah. I remember that. I saw the photo of the space and it's got like higher ceilings. Listen, I mean, like this is the 1, 2, 3. This will be the fourth location I've seen Dark Delicacies in. Because when I first moved to Los Angeles in 99, I remember looking through the LA Weekly because I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't know what Los Angeles is like. I don't know what people go and do. And I found an ad that was like, meet Victoria Price, Vincent Price's daughter, because she was signing his memoirs. And I was like, oh, what is this place, Dark Delicacies? So I took a little drive into the valley and found this very quaint, very small, very cool horror bookshop. And Sue was the first person I met.
Yep.
And
Del's hair black back then? Or
no.
Curious. No,
it's always
Del's
been white.
Always been white.
Interesting. But then they moved on to Burbank Boulevard, and they were literally across the street from my day job. So that, I mean, like every day at lunch,
that's
I would
dangerous.
Just go over. Yeah, I know. It was. I came back with a lot of stuff. And then this location that they're at is their third. But I have to say that out of the locations I've seen them at, this is the one that feels the most advantageous and good for their business, because there's a lot of foot traffic on Magnolia because people are going from the Portos.
Yeah, right on the corner there.
Yeah, right on the corner, and they grab lunch and they walk down to the other end of the strip. And so, you know, the spot that they're at is going to be cool. It's just down the street from Portos, but it's going to miss that foot traffic. So they're going to need all the support from the LA horror fans as they can get. So if you're in town for Monsterpalooza, be sure to check it out. If you're in town for, if you're passing through on the way to Comic-Con, you know, it's just a great destination if you're in town.
Yeah, and I mean, look, they feel like family. I mean, this no matter if you've lived here, you know, as long as we have, or just visiting town, there, that's, you can meet Victoria Price there, or, you know, the latest whatever movie's coming out, doing a signing there. It's a great spot. And
probably the last movie that did a signing there is probably Becca's. So
probably
last week or something.
Yeah. So if you can support it, and that's that. Let's head into some weird ass movies, because I know between the three of us, we have some cross pollination. Ryan, hit me. Let's go into.
You want to go into
Severin films? Let's go right to Skinner.
You want to go jump into Skinner territory?
I'm going to jump right into Skinner.
This is wild. So
who's heard of this movie?
So you might recall I brought this up during our Ted Raimi conversation many episodes ago. And I think some people thought I was dogging on it, but honestly, I wasn't. I was just bringing it up because it's one of those titles that you don't hear a lot of people mention.
Yeah.
But as far and what I got a sense of in our conversation with Ted is that he's kind of proud of it, because he is front and center in this film. And so I bought this new, brand new Blu-ray special edition.
Bless Severin.
I know, seriously.
And they've been trying to do this for like 10 years, apparently.
That's insane. So look at the Severin, box art, and then go back to the VHS box art from 93.
Very different.
Very, very different. And I think that they had problems maybe clearing images, maybe Tracy Lords. But anyways, let me take a look at this, Elric. Yeah, it's
directed
just like,
by Heidi Fleiss.
Yes. Okay. So,
all right. So,
1993.
And if you want something that feels like pure early 90s direct-to-video kind of weirdo, trashy serial killer stuff, this is for you.
Yeah.
Because you've got basically, and it doesn't go further beyond this, Rob. It's basically about a serial killer, played by Ted Raimi, and he shacks up at a bed and breakfast that's run by Ricky Lake. She's basically renting her room.
Siri's getting excited by your description.
I couldn't find Serial Killer in your music, Ryan. Thanks, Siri. So basically, Ricky Lake is renting out a room in her house. She takes in Ted Raimi, much to the chagrin of Ricky Lake's boyfriend, who kind of just disappears.
I think it's a husband, but he's never there. I think he's a trucker that's like never around.
Yeah, I was kind of unclear. Was it a boyfriend or husband?
And a very slick, good-looking young Ted Raimi comes in.
Comes in, but Ted Raimi's got a fixation on killing people, skinning them, and wearing their skin around.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't matter, white or black. At all races.
We'll get to that in a moment, because there is a questionable scene
very problematic. Meanwhile, hot on his heels is Tracy Lords.
Yes.
Who is mumbling her way through this film with hair covering half her face because she's got this weird deformity on one side of her body.
It's yes.
It looks like burn makeup, but the gist is... he attacked her.
Yeah, she's a former victim.
Her scarred, but it looks like burn makeup. And that's all you got, really. I mean, that's really the gist of the story.
Yeah, this is like in the wake of like the Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer sequel. Like when they were making like these, and then like Ted Bundy, they were doing these direct to video kind of like, I don't know if that's what influenced it, but
Richard Schiff. Mm. You've got Richard Schiff from The West Wing playing a sleazy landlord who rents a motel or a hotel room to Tracy Lords and then spends the rest of the film peeping on her through a little hole in the closet.
Yeah.
There's somebody at home right now who was like not in this conversation. They're like, yeah, whatever. And then he said, Richard Schiff. And they're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Oh, shit. I lost you at West Wing.
Fucking
West Wing.
Yeah. Skinner?
You lost me on Tracy Lords or Richard Schiff.
As a peeping Tom, get out of here.
I know. This is a very unusual movie that doesn't go beyond. It's very surface level and doesn't go much beyond that. Even, I mean, there's some really gory stuff, but a lot of the skinning.
The courtesy of K&B, by the way.
Yeah. The process of skinning is done in these kind of quick cuts, fleeting montages, really quick. You don't really see too much gore.
Both Ricky Lake and Tracy Lords are John Waters.
Yeah, serial actors,
so that's kind of interesting, yeah. And that's a serial killer movie. So.
But there is one great centerpiece moment where Ted corners a lady of the night and proceeds to skin her face off. It's pretty gnarly. All the quick cuts make up for the in this one moment. But
there's some gnarly stuff. Now, my memory, I found this on DVD back in the early 90s. I think it was part of a collection.
Really?
That's how I remember it. And I kind of liked it back then. But what's – I mean, again, bless Severin. This it felt like a direct-to-video style full-frame movie back in the DVD days. This is widescreen and totally cleaned up. And like it actually looks – I guess what I'm saying is like I never knew if it was filmed on film.
Skinner never looked this good?
It never looked this good, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But this is the best presentation you can ask of for something as sleazy as Skinner. Yeah. And you know what? I went through the special features. They're pretty great. They do interview the director, Ivan Nagy, who is no longer with us. They did this interview like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, they've been working on this for that long.
Yeah.
So there's a great interview with him. And again, he goes into the whole controversy with Heidi Fleiss, who was his girlfriend.
Yeah, so basically he was part of Heidi Fleiss's ring. Like he had women that he was operating with and was like...
It's called a pimp. He's literally a pimp if you're saying he's operating women. I'm going to go to the sound designer. Well, Ernie, is he a pimp? I think he's a pimp, yes.
Ernie's saying he's a pimp. Well, I was going to say Heidi Fleiss was more of the controlling member of all of that. So
yes, but what's funny is that whole stuff blew up, and then this movie came out, and so even though it was unrelated, everyone assumed this was his statement against prostitutes because Ted Raimi pretty much murders prostitutes this whole movie. That's just like his gimmick. But that's here. There's a new interview with Ted on here, which is excellent. And again, he talked about it on our show when he was on. And then there's some other interesting things like director Jeremy Kasten's interviewed on here because he was the editor. And he tells all these crazy stories about how he had to go find the original footage, edit this movie together, his conversations with Nagy, and just it's pretty wild.
He must have been pretty young back then too.
It was one of his early gigs, but like
but overall, I mean, you know, the first time I saw it was when it came out on VHS back in 93, you know. So my memory was completely, I mean, like I was going into this film with fresh eyes. I don't know.
That was the original DVD cover.
Yeah, that's
the cover. I like that cover.
Yeah.
But that is not what they look like in the movie.
Yeah, the characters?
Tracy Lords definitely doesn't look like that.
Right.
But there's a lot of this. Just I admire the weirdness and the oddball nature of it, and I admire Ted Raimi in it. But it just kind of abruptly ends.
Yeah. No, I kind of like that, though.
Do you? Yeah. I was like, what the hell, man? It's a very unusual film. But it gives Ted a canvas upon which he could play someone who's just completely loopy. Like he's...
And now, Elric, this copy is yours.
Well, it's funny. I know we were going to go into a couple of your picks, but I have something so close to that that's actually funny. A, there's a Raimi connection, and B, it's a serial killer film that's made from probably that same year.
Okay.
And it's something I think I'm the first to do it. A little listener of ours who sent us something called Mr. Tony Elwood, who gave us all Evil Dead 2 props because he worked on Evil Dead. Yeah. He also sent us a Blu-ray of a movie he made called Killer.
Killer.
That's right.
Which is literally sounded exactly like Skinner, except for he doesn't skin. It's just literally a guy. I don't know if there's a lot of story. He's literally a serial killer, and he's kind of on a spree kill, and he just literally, as he sees people, he goes after them, and then you meet a bunch of kids who work around a petrol station, play baseball together, and hang out, and he gets his attention on them, and there's basically a face-off. It's totally simple in terms of the story setup, but what's fun about it is the energy that it's made. It's all shot on Super 8. It's now on Blu-ray. I don't know how hard it is to get. Like, I know he sent us a copy. I don't know if it's available out there to the public. I have no idea. So I just thought, oh, well, you know, he was so kind to send us, you know, this prop from, you know, being production designer at Evil Dead 2 that I wanted to make sure I watched the film. And I had a good time watching it. I really love, I don't want to say reduce it to like backyard filmmaking, but regional filmmaking when people are just going, all right, we've got enough Super 8. I think they made it for like $9,000 and they went out and did it. And it's, you know, it's entertaining. And the lead performance, he's, as the serial killer is just going, it's totally unhinged and he's just having a ball. And there's a really fun interview with them, the two people who made it, and Tony just talking about, you know, how they pulled it off and what it meant to like remaster it all these years later, and how Sam Raimi was really the inspiration, you know, because making a film with these guys was so kind of inspiring and handmade that he went out and made this. So I know, and you know, he's directed a couple films since then.
Right.
Anyway, just one to look out for. I had fun, and it's perfect because it sounds like it's very similar and probably some of the
they're like cousins.
Yeah, and he worked with the Raimi. So you guys should at least definitely watch it.
Okay.
And you know, have a little shot.
I apologize for not having seen it.
You know, like often people do send us stuff. Not that often movies, and it is hard to get to because usually we already have a list of things we're trying to get to each week, but I am also always intrigued with Super 8 things. You know, it's rare that they make it to, you know, actual Blu-ray or something. Yeah. You know, and still some of it you can tell is shot in the dark, and I'm sure they know that. But there's a couple moments that are actually really dynamic and move really well. So good job, Tony, and thank you again for your Evil Dead 2.
I know. Yeah, yes. my crude piece of wall now hangs in our dining room, so everybody can walk by and see the weird.
You only notice if you look closely that it's sexual. If you just pass it, you might not notice. But,
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I think so. This is Killer. I think you can get it from Tony's website, which is tonyelwood.com. Or at least I see a DVD listing on here. But
and it's a perfect length, like 73 minutes. Super 8, you want it to be 70 minutes.
All right, so that's Killer, and then Skinner from Severn, which is an 88 minutes.
Yeah, I think that kind of sounds like a double feature, so I think it's right to
put
them together.
All right, there you go. What else?
So I bask in the glory of Lucio Fulci this weekend. As you guys know, I am a big Fulci fanatic.
Me too. And I'm waiting. And my package is on its way for both Psychic and the one you're going to
talk about. There are a few gaps in my love for Fulci, and Murder Rock was one of them.
Yep, me too. Got to go.
And Ryan, here's why I'm excited for you to talk about this, because I also bought and watched Murder Rock, and I remember nothing about this experience from 2 weeks ago, so please tell me what Murder Rock is about.
All right, Elric, I'm going to talk about Murder Rock in broad strokes for you.
Okay, because I'm going to literally get it the next day.
So basically, Murder Rock is set around a dance school in New York City. Again, you get Fulci's lush, beautiful.
Wait, is this New York Ripper, New York?
Yes, this is New York Ripper,
shit.
New York.
No, but kind of towards a devil's honey.
Oh shit!
Oh, very much
direction.
So. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. This is that Fulci.
Listen, I am absolutely.
I like all these Fulcis.
I am so in love with Fulci's New York. I want. I hope that there is like an option to kind of live in a very specific area, and I'm just going to say to whomever the powers that be, I'm going to be like, put me in Fulci's New York. You know,
select A for heaven, B for Fulci's New York.
C for Hennen Lauder's New York, D for...
Because Fulci's New York, I mean, is also seen in like Contagion. Shares Fulci's New York.
Wow.
Anyways, I
think you have to be Italian to see it that way, basically. You know, you can't be... That's why Hennen Lauder's is a little comicker, you know, a little funnier.
When I die, I want to hear the weird whooping sounds that come out of Fulci's New York, where it's like like it's like wharf sounds that I've never ever heard going when I went to New York in the 80s. Anyways, this is mid 80s and it's basically set around a dance academy where dancers are being picked off one by one in a very specific fashion. They get their clothes torn off, and then the killer, the gloved killer, takes a needle and slowly stabs it into their boob. Then it goes directly into
all
their heart.
Back.
That sounds like it goes right with saxophones.
Yeah. So it goes right on in there. The killer knocks the victim out. So they don't really feel the pain. They're just like, oh, shit. Maybe they're like kind of dulled to the sense. So anyways, the woman who owns the dance academy is like, I got to find out what the fuck's going on. Who's killing my girls? Meanwhile, she has a dream that she herself is being murdered by a very handsome gentleman. And while she's driving along the east side or west side or wherever, she sees a billboard and she's like, oh my God, that's him. That's the guy who killed me in my dream. Somehow she thinks this relates to the murders, so she reaches out to this guy, and he's just like a fucking two-bit actor struggling to make a way in New York. He used to be a former model. He did a lot of ads. So she tracks him to the Fleabag Motel. She sleeps with him. They have an affair.
You say this like you're surprised in a Fulci movie. You're not surprised.
And then and thus begins our story, our murder investigation. And the two work together to find out what's going to happen. Meanwhile, you've got a –
sounds a bit like Night School as a setup.
A little bit. Very much. You've got a hardened detective who's also working the beat. He's not afraid to slap around perps. There's one very long, great interrogation scene where this guy's like, I'm not going to tell you shit, but I did it. And then all of a sudden the cop just grabs him by the throat and starts slapping him around. The guy goes, okay, I totally did it, but here's how it went down. And it's amazing. It's amazing. You get great dialogue like, do you believe in dreams? No, not a bit. Well, you ought to.
Nice.
There's many, many others like that. There's a lot of questionable music.
Yeah.
Keith Emerson contributed the fine score.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah. There's questionable dancing. I've tried a few moves myself. I wound up maybe pulling my back out, doing one very specific
rock.
One. I tried
rock.
To do the murder rock. Listen, this movie,
about this, one.
This you got to
get
excited.
This is like Nightmare Beach. Like, I'm excited to get this in my hand now.
I got to say, between on a level of, on a scale of Night School to Nightmare Beach, I'd say it inches just a little closer to Nightmare Beach. It is incredibly enjoyable to watch. The lead, I mean, like, you've got all like Fulci's repertory company in it. Like, you've got all the actors.
Jaretta Jaretta, isn't it?
Yeah. Jaretta, yes. Yeah.
From
exactly.
Demons. Yeah.
And she's got a great interview on the Blu-ray too. So I recommend you check that out.
Yeah. I mean, that one looks good to me. And also I love it when it's not what you think it's going to be. Like, when it's not just the typical thing. I did finish Channel Zero, Dream's Door, so highly encourage anyone to finish that. I thought it was really good. It stayed up to speed. The film that Becca's, who's not here, but we both were invited to go see, I know it's on VOD now, it's Pledge, which I guess started a bit of a bidding war for like IFC, some of like the indies apparently. But it's we know one of the producers, J.D. Lifshitz, and you've known him for a long time.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Anyway, this film's like really it's an interesting movie because it's I have a feeling with hardcore horror fans who love the extreme, your Hostels and your So On haven't had that for a while. This film is definitely going to deliver for them because it's one of those movies where I had the opposite. I actually told him right after the movie, I was like, it's funny, when I saw Hostel for the first time, it borrows a lot of the same setup. I really didn't like the characters, and then terrible things happened to them, right? In this film, I had the total opposite. The kids, it's about a bunch of kids who go to, they're at college and they're dorks and geeks and they don't fit in anywhere and everyone's rejecting them. They run across some girl who tells them about this party and it seems very unlikely. They go out to this kind of like, you know, mansion and they meet some preppy guys who look like they're right out of the first Purge, you know, the blonde guy. And they're promising them these parties and come back tomorrow and we'll have a thing. And then they come back and there's all these girls. And then, obviously, there's going to be a twist and things get dark and bad. And you can assume that they're pledging for something that they don't fully understand. But the difference here is I really liked the group of kids. Like I really, I found out afterwards a lot of it was improv and it actually took a long time to edit the movie because, and I honestly couldn't tell. And usually I'm really aware because it's usually kind of painful, but the guy who's the lead actor is also the main writer. Mm-hmm. And he's really funny. He's like a young Jewish nerd kid. It's kind of like if, what's the kid from Superbad, Mick?
McLovin.
It almost be like if you're watching
Zach
him.
Wiener.
Yeah, it's almost like you're Zach Wiener. And he's really good in it. And I found myself really liking them, which actually made it quite hard and not as, for me personally, not as enjoyable to watch them when the bad things started happening. I was actually found it because I actually genuinely liked them. So now I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, I don't know if I'm enjoying, because it is torture. But I do think there are certain types of horror fans who this is the kind of horror that they might have been missing, who are really going to dig this, because I thought it was really well done. Like, it was one of those movies where I admired how well it was put together more than I enjoyed it, because, and that's purely on taste, you know what I mean? But and sometimes I can tell the difference where I was like, no, this is just shit. Mm-hmm. No, I can see why this would connect. Also, it doesn't overstay its welcome. It has some pretty good little turns in there, and then it's just done, and it's not a movie that over explains things, and I actually thought that was really nicely played. So I think it's interesting, and I do think Purge did this too. I think there are some kinds of horror movies that are not being made as often anymore, and I think this is definitely filling that kind of void of the extreme for people who are into that, you know, watching bad things happen to good people. But the kids are really fun to watch, and there's pretty good stuff. But I also just kind of, I can't stand, like, you know, frat culture, and it is taking on that culture.
Yeah.
But I find it hard to even watch characters who are, you know, fratty in that, because it's just alien to me because I didn't grow up in that kind of world. But yeah, I think some people are gonna really dig this one.
I don't think any of us did.
Probably not. I doubt many horror. Many people do.
School in New York. I mean, like that. Yeah, it's frats there.
Yeah, and it's a different world. But it did feel realistic to what that could be. And this, it then goes all the way. You know, pushes it further. There's some really actually kind of fun direction turns that make it a little more interesting than what you might think it is if you just go, oh, it's about a pledging, a fraternity, and hazing. Yes, it is all those things, but it has something else going on.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's why you should watch it.
And you said that Darren Bousman showed up as a surprise.
Well, so it said that Bousman, no, so they said up front, oh, he's going to be moderating. And I was like, oh, I wonder what he did on this. And then he just gets up and goes, I don't know anyone here. I literally watched this 2 nights ago, and I thought it was the best fucking movie I've seen in years. And it surprised me, and it frustrated me, and I wanted more at the end. And so, goddamn it, I'm coming down to do the Q&A. I was like, good on you, Darren. Like, I thought that was actually kind of cool to see someone. And he had a good point. He said, when you see something that, and I think he was saying the same thing, like for him, obviously he did Saw 2, 3, and 4, 5, yeah, 2 and 3, and not
and 4.
And 4. So, you know, he's talking from a place of knowing. He was like, you know, go out and tell people if you like this, go let people know, because this is kind of the kind of movie that will only get seen by word of mouth. And so I think that's cool, because he's come from that world. So yeah, I do think this will hit a chord with the right kind of horror fan. There's so many different types of horror now. You too, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, Pledge.
Cool.
Pledge.
Ryan, you got anything else?
Yeah, I'm going to elaborate on my thoughts about a TV show that initially I discovered began on Lifetime back in September. This is called You.
Oh.
I hinted at it a little bit last week because we had just watched the first two episodes. I'm now 7 episodes deep, and this is not going to be for everybody, as the Shockwaves group has proven. but I am absolutely fascinated and completely immersed in this world. Greg Berlanti and Sarah Gamble are the showrunners, and it is a really fun, trashy, twisty, turny, good time. I mean, it basically, the gist for you guys is our narrator is this guy named Joe, played by Penn Badgley, and he is a bookstore clerk living in New York, and this girl named Guinevere Beck, she goes by Beck, played by Elizabeth Lail, she comes in, and he is immediately smitten with her. Like you're driven. The whole show is driven by his voiceover, so you're in his head. It's kind of like Dexter. Dexter had this very calming, soothing voiceover, and that's what Penn has as well. And so you're immediately in this guy's head, and you're like, oh wow, he's really fallen for this girl. He really likes her. Da da da. And they connect over books, and you discover she's got a boyfriend, and you realize that Joe is a full on stalker. Like, he starts to manipulate her life and starts to do things in her life that start to favor what he wants. Mm. So he wants to get the boyfriend, played by Lou Taylor Pucci, out of the picture.
Yeah.
He works on that. Mm. He wants to reconnect with Beck in at the bar in a fun way. He manipulates things to the point where he's able to make it look like it's a natural encounter between the two of them. And so the gist of the show is he gets into a relationship with Beck, and it's basically putting you in the shoes of a stalker. And what this show does in such a dangerous way is he is your hero. He is the guy that you ultimately wind up liking quite a bit. You know what? He is. I've talked to many women around here in the office because we're all like just gossiping about it and talking about it. And they're all like, he's literally the perfect boyfriend. Like, he is super sweet. He's super sweet. He provides her what she needs emotionally. But oh my God, he's also a fucking creeper/stalker/murderer.
Wait, so once a stalker, usually stalkers don't actually get the person, right? So once he gets her, does he keep stalking anything, or is it just
yes.
he keep following
her? He has her phone.
Oh man.
He manipulates. I don't want to give away too much, but he gets to a point where she something happens and he gets a hold of her phone and has instant access to all communication that she has with her family, her friends, everything. And she obviously has to get a new phone as well, but he works things to his favor. So he's consistently keeping an eye on what's going on in her life. And when he feels like she's pushing him away too much, he dials it up, he dials it back. He knows when to lean in and when to lean out in her life. And there's a moment where he starts to meet her best friends, and there's that one best friend who goes by the name of Peach, and she is immediately on to him. They start to verbally spar. She begins to suspect that he's, you know, there's something more than meets the eye with him. And I gotta say, I mean, like, it's very soap opery, and but done in a way, I'm very weird about TV. Like, it takes me a little bit to get into things, and you guys have heard me talk about this in the past, but to get me episode one right into it, that is a rarity. And I am like, I can't wait to see where this ends. But the weird thing about the show is that it played on Lifetime It played on Lifetime last fall. No one saw it. No one talked about it. In comes Netflix, rolls up with the big dough, by season one, puts it out recently, it becomes the talk of the town.
Oh, I thought it was made for Netflix, yeah.
No.
So they're marketing that pretty well then.
Well, I mean, like, I think it's just the kind of water cooler talk that's generated around this show. Anyways, I'm very curious to see where it ends. I think they did a really great job of just kind of crafting a fun story, a dangerous story in which, you know, it's not pure horror, it's not pure thriller. It's just, it leaves you with a lot of feelings. You're just like, well, she's not exactly the greatest girlfriend either, and her friends are kind of dicks. And even though he's got his weird, very questionable, problematic flaws, you remove all of these facets, and he could be the nice, you know.
Are they making
boyfriend.
More of them?
Apparently they're moving into season two for Netflix.
So it's no longer.
So it's very much like Slasher. What happened with Slasher? Slasher was like a sci-fi thing. Yeah. Netflix bought it, did season two. They have an upcoming season three. But anyways, I can't wait to rush back and just kind of finish the last three episodes. John Stamos, I just looked it up.
John Stamos is in it?
Stamos is in it, but he's not in season one. I think they're starting shooting season two. I'm still like gathering my like information about this show because it's just so fascinating to me. And I talked to a lot of our staff in TV, and they're just like, again, they're smitten with the show as well. So very, very interesting series. I see a lot of people. There was one person who chimed in on a Shockwaves group, and it was like, I gave it just a few minutes, and it looked like misogynistic bullshit. And I was like, you got to keep going.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like that at first, but it becomes so much more complex and so much more complicated. But I think what the show does so well is just put you on this guy's side when you really just kind of – you're forcibly try to push yourself away from him, but he's so goddamn charming and so nice, and he does all the right things.
It's lucky that he's good looking. If you made the same thing about an ugly guy,
I mean, it's a fascinating show. Anyways, what's the other one you got?
Well, I got a big one. This was like, it's a shame. Yeah, Rob had to get the guest.
Yeah, Rob.
But a listener, Jason Shohan, who is a Nashville film critic, wrote to me on Twitter. I don't get many. You'd be surprised. We get people recommending us movies in the movie groups a lot, but this was like a private DM, and he just said, I am not exaggerating this when I say this is like a masterpiece. And when somebody pitches me a movie like this, this is what he wrote. He said, this is a film from India, and it is Clive Barker's There Will Be Blood. And I was like, whoa, what? And then he backed up. He goes, I swear to you that this is not overhyping. You just have to trust me. And I'm like, okay. And I then started thinking, I don't think I've ever really seen a major horror film from India. So I was like, okay. And it was just the words, Clive Barker's There Will Be Blood. That is the most accurate description of any movie I've ever heard in my life. Like this movie, I mean, I got to be careful not to overhype this, but it feels like kind of a masterpiece. It's a movie that isn't this little movie. So I was going, okay, what will this be? It's like an epic. It feels like a lot of money spent on this thing. It's called Tumbad. It is on Amazon Prime.
Oh, and yes, I've seen this. Yeah.
Dude, this movie is crazy.
I know. It really is.
It is about
Up. I saw a very early cut before all the CGI had been laid in because we were doing the Indian deal and we were potentially going to bring this in. But I saw it and it was very long.
Yeah.
It was a very long
run. Yeah, it's not long now.
Okay.
It's actually.
But I'm sure the heart of what it is, but it is nuts.
Oh, no.
How do you spell that?
It's T-U-M and then two B's A-D. But it's free on Amazon Prime and it's a 2018 film. So this is a recent film. You know, like at first I was like, okay, what is this? And it starts with these two boys in a village and it's a little too complicated a plot to really go here. But it kind of has a very much a There Will Be Blood vibe. And literally Clive Barker vibe. These two boys, their mom and they look after this older woman who's like their great grandmother and they have to feed her when she's asleep and you don't know why. And the kids aren't meant to do it alone. And this is like the opening. I think it's four. Every cut is like every major like shift is about 15 years gap. That's why I mean epic. It covers this long time span. And in the opening, when they finally get in to see the grandmother, holy shit, it is a creature out of fucking Hellraiser or Lord of Illusion. Mm-hmm. She's like tied. She's connected the bed with shackles. She looks ancient. She's got this like, you know, skin that looks like 200 years old and she's kind of demonic. And I was like, okay, I was already in from like literally minute 10. Like, okay, this is really interesting. It felt like a real hard. Didn't feel like there's something with certain cultures where I'm like, I'm not going to understand. It's going to be like it'll be a little alien to me. This was like totally my kind of horror. So you go from – you find out a little bit and you find out that they're poor and that this rich guy who was their dad lives in this castle but no one goes to the castle because this town is cursed. And at the first 30 seconds might put you off a little because it's a little CGI thing telling you about an old god myth of India. I'm not sure if it's a real one called the Tumbad. It's a different character name. But basically it's this idea his mother could give him all the grain – and food or all the money, and he wanted all the money. And so all the other gods got together and killed this god because he was too selfish or something. There's some, you know, kind of parable like that infuses this whole movie. Anyway, to keep it as simple as possible, the boy grows up. I don't want to give away what happens. There's tragedies that happen. He grows up. We think this kind of village has been kind of burnt down and he won't be going back. He goes back and he has found a way to get these gold coins.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know how he gets them, but he's got one at the start. And you start to realize he starts becoming a rich man in India over the like next 30 years. This is the There Will Be Blood thing. And he has to always go down a deep well shaft, just like There Will Be Blood. But when he goes down this thing, the first time he goes into this thing, it blew my mind. The set is a giant, like you're inside the belly of a beast. It's like a giant cavern that is made out of red, like fleshy substance and kind of breathing. And he's in this thing. And then he's got the circle around him and you don't know what he's doing down there. He makes this weird Play-Doh dough figure out of bread. And you're like, what is this? And then this freaking demon who looks like a king starts coming up to him. He can't enter the circle. He throws the dough thing, and as the demon turns around, he can steal gold from the guy's like weird sack in his back. And you're like, what the hell's going on? And then he escapes up the thing. If I give you any more than that, it's going to start to ruin, because it's really – it also becomes like a moral tale,
yeah,
because it's, you know, it's very much tied into, I'm sure, Indian heritage and tradition. But it also kind of charts the change of Indian culture in the city from when England was ruling to a free India through this one character. Greed. It's about a greedy character, just like There Will Be Blood. It is really quite it's one of those gems where you watch it and somebody's recommending, you're like not expecting much, and then you're like, holy shit, the fact that a movie like that exists and no one's heard of it makes you realize there's movies out there to be discovered.
Yeah.
And one thing it really turned me on to, I mean, really, this is one of the best things I've seen this year, and I hope you get to see it again now that's probably been cut
about an hour 45 according to Amazon.
Yeah, it didn't feel long, but it is epic just because of the scale. But what it really made me want to do, and I think I'm going to start that this year. Every year I like to have like some of a goal. I think I'm going to really try to see as many movies from cultures that I've never seen a horror film from. I've got one sitting on my shelf from Greece that I'd never heard of, and I've rarely seen a horror film from Greece. And then what I want to do is start a letterbox where I will just do call a list around the world of horrors and only do one film from each country. Yeah. And just because I'm just genuinely curious, because there's just countries where I'm like, yeah, we've seen quite a bit from Thailand. We've seen millions of things from Japan, France, but there are those other countries you're like, yeah, I've never seen. I mean, India's got a culture of myth for sure, but I couldn't like come up with one horror film. We know Turkey recently has had the one director emerge. So I'm going to see how that goes. And if you guys have recommendations of ones that really stand out, I'll start doing that this year because it impressed me so much.
That's cool.
If it was average, I would have been like, eh. It really is more than average. It won't be everyone's cup of tea because it's also like kind of a historical epic, but the actual monster movie parts are totally my jam because they deliver completely. And the creature, he probably would have been partially CG back when you watched it.
Yes.
He is fucking awesome. Like, it is like, whoa. It's like part king, part Hellraiser demon, Frank, you know?
All right.
So anyway, too bad.
Yeah, I need to watch it.
So thank you, Jason Sawhan, because the fact that you made me want to see it from that great description, it did not disappoint. So that is my my high point for this
Tomb Bad on Amazon Prime. I already added it to my queue.
Nice. Do it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So Ryan is ducking out, unfortunately.
So I have to go to Sundance tomorrow.
What do you guys got going on there? Anything cool?
We have two films. We have Sweetheart by J.D. Dillard, the director of Slight, and then we have Relive from director Jacob Estes, starring David Oyelowo and Storm Reid and Michael T. Williamson and Alfred Molina. That's where I spent my summer last year. I was on the set of that one. But I am super excited, not just to see our films play, but Veronica and Severin from Good Night Mommy have their new film premiering on Friday night called The Lodge.
I would love to see a new film by then.
Yeah. So just to give you guys a highlight of kind of the stuff that I'm going to check out, there's Memory, which is the making of Alien. There's a new documentary on Alien.
The guy I share a room with where I work, he's a mythologist. Yeah. He's actually apparently the main featured person on it because he connects it all through myth. So his name's Will Lynn, and he's flying out tomorrow, and he will be there. Because that guy, the documentarian who made that, who made the Psycho Shower movie, he was at my school recently doing all those Filmstruck bonus things, and that's where I saw Axel and stuff. So I'm very interested to hear how that one goes.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to check out Memory. I'm going to check out a thriller called Share, The Lodge, Hole in the Ground from Lee Cronin, which is supposed to be it's a new A24 title. I heard it's a slow burn, very effective movie. New film from Baba.
You said A24. You didn't need to say the rest.
Slow burn?
I know. Baba Ganvari, who did Under the Shadow. He's got a new film called Wounds that's premiering. And then I'm going to check out a documentary that I'm very excited about called Hail Satan.
Okay.
That's got a question mark at the end.
All right.
So, I'll be back next week to talk
about we'll give you your own section.
Sundance.
To give us a lowdown on this.
Velvet Buzzsaw.
When isn't that coming to Netflix?
No. Next week.
Sundance,
people
get
to see a little bit earlier.
Is that horror?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Have you watched the trailer?
No, I stayed away. I saw that still, and I was like, oh, wait.
Have you watched the trailer?
The trailer is very
not to.
It's very much a horror movie if you watch the trailer.
It's Dan Gilroy who directed Nightcrawler.
Nightcrawler is definitely kind of a horror film.
All right, thanks, Ryan. And we'll be back with our excellent guest. Stay by. Fangoria turns 40 this year, and issue number 2 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fango's also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is available wherever you download music now. And Fango's book line continues. Joining Preston Fasal's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Totally relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order now. Head over to Fangoria.com to learn more about it and to subscribe. Subscribe today to get issue 3, shipping in April, and $60 gets you a full year subscription and saves you $20 off the cover price at Fangoria.com.
This episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Look, if you open my t-shirt drawer now, a large percentage of tees comes from them. Rob, I'm sure you agree with this.
My sock drawer is overflowing with Fright Rags.
They're my number one source for horror t-shirts. They're your number one source for horror t-shirts with specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists. They offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. This week, I just got my Ghostface tee that's in the style of the old t-shirts that you found advertised in Fangoria. I thought that was pretty cool.
Got that for my girlfriend.
Yeah. So what's on tap now for Fright Rags? They just launched a Predator t-shirt and pin collection. Also available, knit horror beanies featuring Trick or Treat, Krampus, Predator, Night of the Living Dead, and the cast and crew beanie that we gave to our cast and crew on the new Halloween film. Coming next Tuesday, January 29th, all new t-shirts for Poltergeist. Poltergeist 2, fellas. Sorry, Elric Rob, no Poltergeist 3.
What?
But Amityville Horror. You don't want to miss out on those. Shockwaves listeners can save 10% now at checkout by entering code WINTERSHOCK10. Again, that's WINTERSHOCK10 at checkout. Again, 10% off. Go shopping. Tell them we sent you.
If you want to sell some t-shirts, I want Amityville 2 and Poltergeist 3. Okay? That's all I want.
Right, welcome back, and we are very excited by our special guest today. It's somebody that we've talked about having on the show before, never followed through until right now for a very special reason. I don't know why, but basically because for Los Angeles friends, this Tuesday, January 29th, there's going to be a triple bill at the New Beverly. This is exciting. Poison Ivy, Streets, and Strip to Kill, and they were all directed by our special guest, Kat Shea. Welcome.
Finally, you have me on.
I know. I'm so sorry.
We had to wait till someone put out a triple feature. Couldn't just do it.
This was it. But part of it
it's
is because.
It's about time here, Rob.
Only, I mean, isn't this crazy that they're all on film, too? They're showing.
Yeah, in 35 millimeter.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
The
How
only
cool
one
that?
I haven't seen is Streets, which I own on DVD, but since it's playing, I want to see it for the first time on
you
the big screen.
You own it and you never watch it?
I haven't watched it yet.
Well, and this is one of the – usually with guests too, like the first thing if there's a hole in our filmography, so I haven't seen Streets either, and that's the one that looks just amazing to me from the trailer. I would rush to see it, but because of this, we wanted to have you on to help promote it, but in the same token, I'm not watching that on DVD. I'm watching that on 35 millimeter
with
next
an audience,
week,
yeah.
And I'm excited about it. So I mean, that one looks bonkers, so
it's
I can't wait.
It's super violent.
Yeah.
I would never make that movie now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's a product of its time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was in a different place then, and I don't know. Can't tell you what motivates, but
okay.
It's really good. I love it. Christina Applegate is fantastic.
And that's while she was on Married with Children,
yes,
or right around then? Yeah, okay.
It was while she was.
That's a big deal because she was huge during that. Yeah.
She's a really good actress.
Yes. Yeah.
She's amazing. People don't know how good she really is.
Yeah.
And it's a dramatic part, and she plays this girl who is homeless.
Mm-hmm.
She can't read, and she falls in love with this kid who – and she's a hooker, basically. You know, she tries her best not to be, but she falls for this kid who's run away from home. His dad's a dentist, and his dad and mom have gone away for the weekend, and he's run away from home for the weekend to come and make it in L.A. as a musician.
Hmm.
And he finds her, Dawn. And it's a love story.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no horror at all. It's just about the two of them, right?
That's it. Violent.
Oh, wait. Where does that come in? I've seen the trailer.
There's a cop who's a no good cop and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's kind of good, though. I mean, while I was shooting it, I really was into it.
And this is one you made for Roger Corman.
I did.
All right. We're going to delve into all
like
that.
Blumhouse is like the new Corman, but with a lot of money, right?
Yes. And, yeah. And Universal's backing.
Wow. Pretty cool.
But started similarly. Yeah. When you think about it.
Yeah. Very similar.
It takes one little movie. And
it's got that vibe, though.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the offices are totally different, right? Yeah. This is really plush. It's really, really nice. But there are vibes of Roger Corman here.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I mean that in the best way, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, we love and revere Roger. And and actually, one of the first we're going to jump all over the place, so forgive us, Kat. But I think Roger is a good starting point because when I had met you because before directing, you were an actress, and you happened to be in a little movie called Psycho 3, right, directed by Anthony Perkins. And the way that our interview came together for the film just – it just happened really quick. I was in town. I interviewed Mick Garris. Mick had known you and said, hey, I can put you in touch with Kat. Wow. And my memory is I emailed you, and within the next day, I was there shooting an interview with you. And I love those kind of interviews because you were thinking about this film for the first time in like 20 years or whatever it had been. And I just love getting that natural reaction from people reminiscing about an experience. But Psycho 3 was such a pivotal film for you in a number of ways, one being it was kind of your last acting gig, but also, if I remember correctly, didn't you working with the effects artist directly tie into Strip to Kill?
It did.
All right, so what was that story?
It's so incredible because there's so many synchronicities that are involved with, I don't know, my whole career in Hollywood. It's like, you know, I also worked on Scarface, which was Brian De Palma directing, and Brian De Palma was so influenced by Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And then I end up in Psycho 3, and Anthony is directing it. And at that time, I knew that I was going to be directing Strip to Kill. I would tell people, I said, this is my last acting role. And they go, yeah, sure. I go, no, I'm not kidding. I'm not acting anymore, okay? In that movie, you know, Anthony, not only did he slit my throat, he threw me out a window. I landed on my chin like this, and I'm dead, so I can't blink. Mm-hmm. Okay? So landing, not blinking, then he drags me around dead. Mm-hmm. I'm dead through a rainstorm. He puts me in a trunk of a car that goes underwater. He pulls me out dead, and I'm like the love interest.
Yeah.
I happen to be dead the whole time, but never. The less.
That seems the perfect one to end an acting career on. It's like, if you're asked to do that, that's the one to go out on.
It is perfect. But what Rob's referring to is Mike Westmore was my makeup artist on this movie. Now, he's so overqualified to be putting like mascara and foundation on an actor. I mean, he did do the prosthetic neck and everything, but he's also doing like my mascara. I cannot believe this. Okay. He won the Academy Award for Raging Bull.
How crazy.
You know, I mean, he's done amazing things. His whole family was in, you know, special effects makeup. The man is absolutely incredible. So I had the audacity to ask him, because at this time, I was still trying to convince Roger Corman to do Strip to Kill. Mm-hmm. And not as a spoiler or anything, but I have to tell.
Yes.
Like, I kind of have to tell, you know, the end of Strip to Kill.
Mild
spoiler. The movie's like 30 years old.
Yeah, I finally
tell?
There's a moratorium on that.
Okay.
You're good.
Okay, good.
Just don't ruin your second film because I need to see it.
All right. I won't ruin Nancy Drew for you.
Oh, okay. I just watched the trailer.
It's rated PG, by the way.
Not quite as hardcore. Yeah.
So I ask him if he'll write a letter to Roger about these prosthetic breasts because in Strip to Kill, the bad guy has a twin sister. He kills the sister. He replaces her, and he happens to be a sculptor, and he works in foam, and he works in all these other mediums, and he makes these breasts, and he actually passes himself off as her as a stripper, okay? So in a G-string.
Yeah.
Okay. So Roger, he was really into this pitch that I'm telling you, I'm going to do this movie, okay? And this is the story, and it's strippers, and it's like, you're going to love it, right? And Roger's like, his eyes are bugging out. Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah. You know, yes, I want to do it. And I go, and the bad guy is the twin brother, and he's posing as the stripper. And he goes, what? Like, this is before Crying Game. So, you know, nobody had pulled this off before. I go, yeah, yeah, we can pull it off. I promise you I can pull this off. So I asked Mike if he would do it, first of all. He goes, oh, yeah, I'll do that for you. No problem. I was like, wow, Mike Westmore is going to do this. I go, can you write Roger a letter and tell him that we can actually pull this off? And he did that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Which was amazing. And so Roger is slowly coming over, but he's still not there, right? So I start sending – it's like mash mail. I'm sending him pictures of guys. I would send him a picture of like a real stripper and then a guy posing. And I go, which one's the real girl? And it was really hard to tell. This is like – nasty stuff I'm sending him. But, you know, I didn't think of it like that. You know, I was just like, I just want to make this movie, you know.
had you, at that point, had you worked with Roger on anything, or you were just
I had acted in a couple of movies.
I got you. And you made it known your desire to direct.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I acted in a couple movies for him, but I kept shooting second unit on those movies.
Oh.
Because I go, to the director, you know what you could use as like a shot? You need this like wide shot. And he goes, I don't have time for that. I go, just give me a camera. And I would do it.
Where did that come from? Like, did you have were you a young cinephile, or where did you learn film before this?
Yeah. Well, when I was 12 years old, I was putting on plays in my backyard. Uh-huh. And I was really, you know, just like, I was just wanting to make money. Mm. And because my parents never gave me an allowance. So I really needed to make money. So I put all these kids in the neighborhood in my productions, and their parents would pay me all this money. So I had this great idea that, wow, directors make a lot of money, you know, because I would charge them $5 to see their kids. And at the time, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just really, I don't know. Yeah, I was always shooting things and writing things and casting people in things. So,
were movies a big part of like your childhood there? Like, was there any family members who got you into like a certain type of movie, or did that just kind of come later?
You know, my parents went to the drive-in every Friday night. So the drive-in was fascinating for me because they would play like a really acceptable movie like The Trouble with the Angels, like with Haley Mills, you know, because my mom's, you know, my parents were really Catholic. And so we go see The Trouble with Angels. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they would play like an R-rated movie, like Clute.
Yeah.
But I don't sleep. So everybody's asleep in the back of the station wagon after The Trouble with Angels, and I'm like awake watching Clute, you know, like my eyes are like, oh my God. But it really made a deep impression, you know. So, I mean, I wondered about that too, because it's like, why did I grew up in this really, you know, solid middle class, very religious background. And here I'm making these movies that are like really like gritty and dark and everything.
We can bring it all back to Jane Fonda.
It's Jane Fonda.
As a prostitute.
Again, Jane is at fault here.
But it is, you know what, the amount of times I've heard that exact version of certain directors that we've met that were at a drive-in and people aren't noticing what they are seeing in like, say, the rear view or the front. And it's fascinating because a little bit part, like our generation missed out on that being a cultural part. And it's just fascinating, you know.
Oh, it's fascinating because it was really designed this way because, you know, there's the playground and the kids all go out there and you play as hard as you can and you're a merry-go-round, you're doing all this stuff. Then you watch Haley Mills and then you go to sleep, right? But I don't sleep.
Yeah, I love that. That's so fun. Yeah.
But I never let them know that I watched, you know, all
those.
Was that
the craziest one you remember?
Connection.
Oh, French Connection. Okay, so that's pretty intense.
I saw everything. I saw all those movies that, you know, my dad wanted to see.
Yeah.
My dad was putting up with all this stuff so he could see, you know, something interesting.
Was he aware that you were always watching?
Oh, no.
Okay,
no,
interesting.
No, they would not have done that. They were quite confident that I was completely asleep.
Do you have any recollection of a horror film from that period, or was it mostly these kind of more mainstream?
Well,
action?
Psycho.
Okay, so Psycho, you saw like that? In that or not?
You know, no, I didn't see Psycho at the drive-in. My first recollection of it is on TV in black and white, you know, and it's small TV, but scared the crap out of me. I mean, I didn't take a shower for years.
I love that. So, that and Jaws are always the ones people say. They had that real influence, you know?
So
I'm sure all those things together end up creating some psychological thing for you where you do want to make movies with this kind of explore this stuff. It's interesting. It's never one thing.
Yeah. No, but I didn't know I was going to be a filmmaker at that time, you know?
Did you want to act, or was that just something that kind of fell?
No, I feel initially. Like I feel like acting came second to, you know, when I was putting on the plays in my backyard and I had complete control over everybody. That was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. You know, and I make money at it. You know, so the acting really came secondary, and it was more it was. Which is odd, you know, that that was kind of my way in.
Yeah.
Because who would think that? You know, usually it's the opposite way. You have to write something and then direct something and then get yourself in it as an actor. But for some reason, you know, that came easier. Maybe it's because the thing that you're really supposed to do comes later. I don't know.
Yeah. But it's, I guess we hear that about Roger Corman quite a bit, that he is open to giving people a chance. And obviously, he was better than most producers at that time to give women a chance to get behind a camera, especially the Slumber Party Massacre movies are all direct. So it's interesting. Was it as easy as that sounds, or was there still a lot of convincing that had to happen for someone like him?
God, it took me over a year to convince him to do Strip-to-Kill. And then it was just horrible the whole time. I finally went to a club called La Caja Fall, and I wanted to meet some female impersonators so that I could see what they were doing, and I wanted to convince somebody to come with me to tell Roger what he would do with this junk, you know, like, so you wouldn't see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so could we really convince an audience on film that it was a real, you know, it was a girl.
Yeah.
So I convinced this guy to come with me to Roger's office. And he was a female impersonator, and he was really shy. What a dear, sweet young man he was. And he comes with me, and he looks like a guy at this point. So he's not in, you know, drag or anything. And we go into Roger's office, and he proceeds to tell Roger. Now, I don't know if you guys know what Roger Corman is really like.
I don't think we do. I think we've met him. You've talked to him. But then I always hear from people who knew him better. There's a whole other side to him.
I mean, he's a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
This is not a guy in gold chains with a hairy chest. You know, that much we know.
Yeah. Right? You're right on that.
He's proper. Yeah. You know, he's very proper. He's very, you know, he'll say, hello, Kat, would you have a seat? And what are you pitching to me today? You know, like he's very, very proper. And this sweet young man just starts to tell him, I said to him, so tell Roger what you do to, you know, just make sure that nothing is shown. And he proceeds to tell him like gory detail, like about pulling things down and tucking and all this stuff. And
later in Silence of the Lambs, we've seen all
that. No, he turns purple. I see his face, like it's turning redder and redder. It's like going blue, you know, and then purple. And he's like, get out of my office. He ordered us out of his office. And he says to me, he goes, you can do it. Just get out.
Oh, wow.
Right? Now, these are his words, okay? You can do it. Just get out.
Wow.
So, and then he calls me on the phone. So I'm at home. I'm all excited. I'm like, I'm going to make a movie. I'm writing and directing a movie. This is so awesome. Yeah. And then he calls me on the phone. Hey, Roger. Yeah. He goes, you can't do it. And he goes, I'm not doing it. And I go, yes, you are. I can't believe I did this because I'd done nothing at this point.
Yeah.
I'm 20, I don't know, I was 20 something.
Yeah.
And I go, yes, we are. We're doing it. We're doing it. And he's going, I said no. I go, yeah, but we are. We're doing it. And he finally just hangs up on me and he was like, okay, we're doing it. I guess we're doing it. So
there's a lesson there. Just don't take shit, you know?
No, it's really, but I don't even know where that came from. It was like, what did I just say? You know, because,
well, he was.
Yeah.
He was
doing it.
He was reluctant. Well, I find it hilarious that he was reluctant to do it because he didn't believe that we could convince. Considering the things in his movies that are so outlandish, he didn't believe that you could properly convince an audience.
I guess,
that a man could disguise himself as a woman.
I think that was it. And you know, the funny thing about that is, you know, he was so hard to convince. It took me over a year, and then he says yes, and then he says no, and. You know, Strip to Kill made more money for him than he had made in like very long time. I'm not, I don't want to say how long because I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah.
Right.
But it made so much more money.
Due to what? Was that like early cable? What was it? Which,
no, it wasn't like driving in anymore. Europe.
Oh,
in Europe, it was a huge theatrical success.
Oh,
you know, it was the number one movie in France.
Wow.
I mean, like the number one.
Yeah. That's wild, huh?
And so, yeah. So,
so it took him that long, but how quickly did it take him to green light the sequel?
Oh, you know, I mean, he
agreed. Did you get that call right away?
Yes, but he cut my budget in half. He cut the days in half. It was ridiculous.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did he see you like a different commodity after the first one, or did, was he just trying
after
to explore
it made a ton of money.
That's what I mean. Like, is he seeing you? Do you but you don't really have any more power necessarily with him, right? It's more just, you know.
You know, I'm – well – okay, here's the other thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I shoot the movie and the footage is great and everything like that, but everybody, they kind of didn't like me because I came in, I swooped in, and I kind of usurped a lot of people that were in line to direct, right? So they weren't really helpful. Like, they didn't tell me the rules. And so I showed Roger a 2-hour rough cut. You don't do that. Okay, you have even if you have to hide footage, it doesn't matter. Hide it, but show him an hour and a half.
Yeah,
like, and I think mine was over 2 hours, so he hated me. Like, he walked out. I mean, I was like throwing up in the bathroom. It was so bad. He was just horrible. It was like my, he was like my evil father. You know, like an evil father figure. I was like, oh my God, this is just. It was devastating. And then he came down to the editing room and he's chopping everything up because he wants it short. He wants it, you know, he wants to ship it. He wants it 83 minutes or whatever.
Five reels or whatever.
As much boobs as possible and 83 minutes. So so really I was on the outs.
Yeah.
You know, he was never going to talk to me again. He was. I was never going to direct another movie again. That was it. And then it just explodes,
and
right?
Made all this money.
He's making more money on this than he's made, you know, in 10 years or something. And so he calls me, which was amazing in itself, you know, like, hello, Kat. Nice. Would you, we're thinking that you should direct another movie for us. Yes, we would like you to come in on Monday and give me some of your ideas, right? So, you know, I come in on Monday, I pitch some stuff, and he's like, do that one, go ahead. You know, 15 days, $300,000. But nowadays, that's actually, like, you know.
Well, now that's not on celluloid yet. It could be cheaper now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was hard. I mean, you know, shooting that in 35 millimeter was quite tricky. And
did you so? Did it change how the freedom you had on the second one, or was he more trusting in like your cut, or did it not really change?
I think he went out of town.
Okay, that works too.
I think he went out of town, and though I could do whatever I wanted, and you know, it's kind of dangerous because you know I'm one of those that you know, oh, the cat's away, let's go.
Yeah.
So it was really fun, you know. He gave me – this is what happened. He gave me this crappy set to shoot on because he had already shot another movie there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like this haunted house with cobwebs and stuff. And we completely changed it into this vampire's house with really modern. And it was like Frank Lloyd Wright kind of thing. And the walls were actually lit from within.
Okay.
And it was the vampire's house. So we changed everything. But, you know, he kind of loved that. I think he loved that kind of rebellious thing. It's like, oh, I give her something like that and then she does this whole different thing. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, I do always like that. He's always seems to be that guy who goes, you make two good films for me and then you go do your own. You know, he lets people – he doesn't try to hold people back, it seems. And
yeah, well, I made more than two. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, well, there you go.
being female, it doesn't really work that way.
Yeah, not quite as simple.
Yeah.
When was the first –
it takes a lot longer.
When was the first –
before we get to – because it was a few Corman movies, including Streets and then Poison Ivy, which was a big one. But I'm just curious if your years acting before that, how much that informed or prepared you to be a director, because directors, we hear all the time, I mean, even your experiences with Anthony Perkins, it's like a director that knows what it's like to be in an actor's shoes might direct a different way than just a traditional director.
I think it's enormously helpful. It's enormously helpful, especially because, you know, acting, I'm not a natural. You know, so it was really, I tended to be really shy, actually. And so for me, being on the set and having a camera on me and everything, that was not a place that I was particularly comfortable. I remember a director coming up to me and saying, "You're shaking." And I'd go, "Yeah, I shake the whole time." He goes, "The camera doesn't pick it up." And I was like, "I know. I know it doesn't. Thank goodness it doesn't, because I'm shaking the whole time." So I think that that is probably the part that is so helpful, is because I know how scary it is. So I'm really gentle with the actors, and I really I feel like I really help them to do their best performances because I know how difficult it is. I know how scary it is. Everything's out there. I mean, you're naked.
Yeah.
You know? If you're doing it right.
Yeah. No, I have a great deal of respect for actors because I wouldn't want to do that gig. But so let's talk about Poison Ivy and making that transition, because that was a studio movie, correct?
It was New Line.
New Line.
Yeah.
But also,
it was an independent, but you know.
But how do you go from being in Roger's world to getting an outside offer, I guess, is part of that? Like, yeah. How does that come? Because it feels so insular and separate to me in my brain. But
well, you know, Bob Shea actually kind of just came after me. So.
Bob Shea's a through line lately, because we had Lynn Shea on a couple weeks ago, and she was talking a lot about how she's wonderful. Hilarious, but, you know, so, yeah.
She's fantastic. It was incredible, actually. I mean, I got a call while I was – that's kind of jumping ahead. So Bob Shea, you know, saw Street somehow and – wanted I was working with Andy Rubin at the time. We were partners, and he wanted us at New Line, and he put us together with Melissa Goddard and Peter Morgan, and Melissa told us this story that was her true story, which became Poison Ivy.
Wow.
What?
Which character was she?
Yeah, she was, you know, the Sarah Gilbert character.
Wow. So it was like a stepsister kind of scenario.
Yeah,
wow.
It was true.
Huh.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know about that. I mean,
I didn't know that had any truth.
She came from kind of a Hollywood family, and the dad is a famous producer.
Oh, interesting.
Be able to.
So it's not brags tracker. About it. Actually.
Okay. So it's not Google. It is Googleable. Maybe
you probably could Google.
Yeah.
Well, how much did you work with them to develop that as a vehicle for you to direct?
Yeah. I mean. You know, she told us sort of the broad strokes, and then Andy and I wrote the script. We wrote the story. You know, we created it out of that. Yeah.
Well, my memory is like that. There's a few things about it that I remember distinctly. One, it was like the first adult Drew Barrymore role.
Yeah.
You know, she had been so famous as a kid actor. And
as
then
a kid. You didn't even know what she looked like, right?
Yeah, I think it was the first time we saw her as an adult. And also she'd had a lot of trouble, if you will, with, you know, substance abuse as a little kid, which is kind of crazy. So I remember that. And I also remember it spawned the – I don't know what to call it.
So many copies, right?
Yeah.
The babysitter movie.
Like
the Lolita riffs.
And
Lolita riff, yes.
Well, even more important than that, you got us. Sexy Skerritt.
Tom
Skerritt looking sexy is not something that instantly comes to my mind, but I remember that. I've probably seen that movie more than most of that decade. It's just one of those movies that you know, when you're young, certain movies.
You liked it.
That was one
Thank
of those
you.
Movies. And, you know, Drew Barrymore, and, you know, it wasn't Skerritt that got me in, but I now, as an older guy, I'm looking at like, yeah, good job, Skerritt. You held your own.
It was Barrymore, and you stayed for Skerritt.
Yeah. But I mean, it feels like a really big, I haven't seen it in a few years, you know, but it felt like that feels like a big movie in a way. I mean, it's intimate where it's the setting, but
it influenced so many movies afterwards. That was the amazing thing. You know, went to Sundance.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, because I don't think Bob expected this to happen, Bob Shea.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, I got a call from the curator at MoMA this is what they were after, was Dance of the Damned. My little vampire movie. It's somebody had seen it, and the curator of MoMA called me, and he said, "We want to show Dance of the Damned at MoMA." And first of all, I thought it was a crank call. I was like, "Who is this? Cut it out. Get, you know, like, I'm hanging up now, you know. And it was really the real guy. Hmm. So once I realized it was the real guy, I said, hey, I've got some other movies. Do you want to see those too? And he did. Hmm. And then and I happened to be editing Poison Ivy. I was in the editing room when I got the phone call, and I got this really cool movie that I'm editing right now, and you should really see that too. Mm-hmm. So he does a whole retrospective from Strip to Kill, Strip to Kill 2. He does Dance of the Damned. He does Streets. And then it's the premiere of Poison Ivy at MoMA.
Oh, wow. That's not where I would have thought of it.
So and then the British Film Institute followed suit. They've heard about it from MoMA and flew me over to London. And
weird.
We did the
suddenly
same
highbrow.
Thing.
Yeah.
I know. I'm suddenly highbrow.
Yeah, it's
I went from Roger Corman, like begging him, right, stalking him to do this stripper movie, to being like, I'm really highbrow now.
Yeah.
They had a poster of me, my head, like at the British Film Institute, that was the size of like an entire like wall, but you know, at the institute, so it's like, I don't know, 40 feet high, and I was just like, holy crap, this is wild, you know?
Yeah. No, it's incredible. I mean, it's funny how these films, they keep finding life. I mean, Scream Factory is putting this out again with the three sequels, which is ridiculous.
I'm not that happy about that, though.
Yeah. Well, how, you know, what what came from the success of Poison Ivy, other than a bunch of sequels?
Well, you know, I didn't work for 6 years after that.
And
so
why was that?
I really feel like I hit the glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. It was like, I don't know, my agent told me you know, actors don't want to be directed by women. Mm-hmm. So it was like, okay, you know. And I mean, I met everybody in town. I met every producer in town, every studio head, everybody.
So you made a hit for them, and it didn't help break that. That's shocking.
No, and not only that, the next movie I got was The Rage Carry 2, which was in trouble. And Jeff Kleeman called me, and Jeff Kleeman I love. He was the vice president of MGM at that time, and Lindsay Duran was it was UA. He was vice president at UA, and Lindsay Duran was the president at UA. And Frank Mancuso was running MGM. And they were going to pull the plug on it and shelve it. They were like,
they had already started shooting, right?
2 weeks into shooting.
2 weeks into shooting.
They're gonna and so, because Jeff called me, I said, I can't do that. I mean, I can't. I haven't worked in 6 years, and I can't do it. Mm-hmm. And I really thought. But he said, well, okay, we're gonna shut it down, and that's it. The actors are done. Everybody's done. It's not, you know. So I hung up and I said, I can't do it. And I called him back, like, I don't know, maybe it was the next day or something like that. I said, what's happening? He goes, we're shutting it down. We're not. I said, okay, I'm interested. I'll meet. So I went in and I met with Lindsay Duran. I thought, it's better than shutting down the whole production. Yeah.
Did you get to see anything, to see the kind of style that they were going for?
Yeah. I saw. Yeah, I mean, that's what they didn't want. So here's the funny thing. Yeah. So they send me to North Carolina and they go, okay, we'll fix it and use this footage. And I was like, I'm not using that footage. You guys fired him for that. Why, I'm supposed to match to this footage now? Yeah. Are you crazy?
Wow.
And then I hired Don Morgan. Do you know Don Morgan, the DP?
No.
Oh, my God. This man is just – he's amazing. I think he's like he's in his late 80s now. God, I would work with him forever.
What are some of the things he would have shot? I'm sure they'll come.
Starman.
Okay. Then yeah, we've just been talking about Starman and Creepshow, so of course we do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he shot the most amazing movies, and I ended up hired him by accident, which is really embarrassing. But you know, I thought he shot a different. I thought he shot The Wall, and it turned out to be a different The Wall.
Yeah.
But it was the greatest blessing ever. Go. I mean, they fly him to North Carolina, and I meet him, and I go, oh my God, I love The Wall. He goes, well, how'd you see it? He goes, it's not out yet. And I was like, okay. He goes, are you sending me home? And I went, no, let's talk. You know, he'd shot so many amazing movies, and he was the best partner you could ever want to have. I mean, you know, because I really kind of went out on a limb on Carrie 2, because I figured, you know, they're somebody's getting fired for this work. Yeah. I'm going to go for it, you know. So yeah. I really did, and I was shooting all this crazy stuff and these hallucinations and these things. And I actually got lost at one point. I'm shooting something, and the script supervisor couldn't follow what I was doing. And the DP, it's, I've got Don Morgan yeah. now. He goes, I don't know where we are either. I go, but do you care?
Yeah.
I go, this is a hallucination. Let's just go for it. Let's just and that. And it's, I think it's one of the best parts of the movie.
That's cool.
I really do. You know, it's like.
And I'm just realizing now, because we talked about the Hitchcock end, but this is, and then you have another De Palma connection, right?
Yeah. Because yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Is there any pressure? I guess there's always pressure to make a follow up to anything that's a classic, even being in a Psycho 3 or a part two
but
of this.
Here's the funny thing. I had to get approved by Brian De Palma for doing Carrie 2 because he had approval over the next director. I don't know how that managed to happen, but I'm on the set on the phone with Brian De Palma going, yeah, I was in Scarface. Don't you remember me?
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
And he goes, no, but he goes, you sound great. Go ahead. You know, so it was kind of fun, you know.
Wow.
It's just all these weird synchronicities about Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you feel by the end of it you were able to make it your own and your own, you know, as much as you could? That's good. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I basically started over and it was fine with them as long as I didn't spend any more money or get any longer schedule.
None of the footage appeared from the previous?
I think there might be one shot of an overhead establishing thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's a really cool movie and you had a pretty awesome cast in it. And I think, refresh my memory, because I was young at the time when it came out, but I think it did fairly well when it came out. Or
you
did
know,
it, not?
It did okay. I mean, the reviews are mixed. Some of the critics thought it was like sheer genius and others were like, this is garbage, you know. But it's always going to be like that, I think, you know.
In that 6 years, I mean, because I guess this is very this is still very relevant for women filmmakers, right? Like, the Oscar nominations were yesterday, and I've seen probably more great movies by women directors this year than I have in my entire life, and yet there's still no woman, Lynn Ramsey to me was the best director of the year, but she's not nominated. So, so it's interesting. So obviously things change, but they haven't changed, right? Mm-hmm. In that 6 year, though, did you get close on big things? Did you ever get to really see why? I mean, you got that one comment, which seems to be more honest than you'd probably hear from most people, saying actors don't want to be directed by a woman. Was there anything else you learned in that period? And how much did you, I have to imagine, question whether you're ever going to do this again? And were you thinking what else you would do? And
yeah, well, I was allowed to write. Mm. You know, I would write things, and they would pay me to write.
So it's just the power of directing. They're trying to.
It was just really weird.
Yeah. Were you offered things that you just weren't that passionate about?
I wasn't really offered too much. I was like, you know, I was offered to do some knockoffs of Poison Ivy, but that was.
Were you offered the sequel, the part two?
I should have done that. Yeah. That was a mistake because, you know, I think we could have kept the integrity of it a lot more. So yeah, I kind of regret that one. Yeah.
It's just interesting to me because like Hollywood, and this is coming from a totally different angle, but Hollywood to me has always been good at exploiting what works. And it seems like you had made this film that really probably surprised people how successful it is. It's shocking to me that you wouldn't then be exploited, have tried to use you.
And she did that a few times.
Yeah,
like Strip to Kill was not supposed to be the big movie it turned out to be for Roger, and then again with Poison Ivy.
No, but I'd be called in and meet with studio heads who were gushing about it. And then it was like, okay, well, can't you give me something?
Yeah,
I mean, you know.
Weird.
Wow. So, it was really weird. I mean, my agent told me to cut my hair.
Huh.
Wow.
I did, too.
What an odd
to just seem, what, more masculine? Is that the idea?
Oh. Yeah.
Well, let's hope we don't go backwards to that.
Yeah. You know?
No, I mean,
it's hard to imagine.
Well, it's very exciting now because I think – you know, I feel like maybe, you know, and I'm very skeptical, honestly, but I feel like maybe things are changing a little bit.
I hope.
There's certainly more movies being directed by women. And,
people
I
can
loved,
be more vocal,
loved,
that's for sure.
Leave No Trace.
Uh-huh. I love that. Deborah Granick. Yeah. And she, that's one that probably would have been nominated just based on kind of the performances.
And just the whole feel of it is so real and, I don't know. It took you into a whole different world, and I really liked it a lot. So.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that you were involved with this movie, but let's talk a little bit about your new one. So this is what – I feel bad that Becca's not here because Becca is a huge Nancy Drew fan.
She's a fan of yours. She's a fan of Nancy Drew. So it's very unfortunate. And she's a woman director who just made her first film. So a few months ago. Yeah. So it would have been nice. But
yeah, so you did Nancy Drew and the Hidden Staircase, mm-hmm. which comes out March 15th.
Yeah.
And this is produced by Ellen DeGeneres and her company. So mm-hmm. how did this come about?
Jeff Klieman. Again.
Okay. Wow.
You know? Jeff Klieman's got the longest memory in, you know, the entertainment business. Really, he went looking for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And is that something like, because obviously this is like young adult. It's for people not familiar yet with the trailer, it has the star of It.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a big deal because she was fantastic. She's kind of, to me, Sophia, the lifeblood of that movie.
You know?
Yeah, her presence
she's
in that is
the young Beverly.
Is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's a really interesting choice to play in Nancy Drew. So that's really cool.
Oh, she's so good in it.
But it's like, is the kind of making, because, you know, having made things that are all, they're all a lot of, you know, you have got films about young people, but they're the kind of raw versions, right? So this is obviously going to be a whole different vibe.
It's PG.
Yeah. Was that something you had to like kind of adapt to or rein yourself in?
You know, because in the years, you know, I mean, I hadn't directed anything in 17 years. Mm. And it's like, I don't think I'm supposed to say that, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
And I've changed a lot. And I wouldn't direct the same movies that I directed, you know, 25 years ago. And I didn't want to do stuff that was really violent or really sexual. I didn't want to do any of that stuff. And so Jeff calls me and says, we're doing Nancy Drew. And I just went, oh, my God, this is awesome. Mm. I was so excited. I was like, how could this even be coming to me? This is just, like, magical. Because I don't want to do any of that stuff anymore. I want to do something that a 7-year-old can watch, mm-hmm. you know? So it was, I don't know, it just kind of came together beautifully, and it's the favorite movie I've ever directed.
Mm. Oh.
So.
And is the goal, do you think? I mean, not you don't know how it's going to do, but is it to like a series, like you're building up to be the Nancy series? You think,
yeah, or? I mean, I think that is definitely what Warner Brothers is hoping for, and mm-hmm. Jeff is hoping for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Chip Diggins produced it. Do you know who Chip Diggins mm-hmm. is? Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah, he's really... he's a wonderful, really wonderful person and wonderful producer. So with having Jeff Klieman and Chip Diggins is like
– did it give you the directing bug again? Like did you feel like, oh,
yeah,
this is what I should be doing?
Unfortunately, it kind of did.
But it's not. It's a bigger canvas, right, than probably anything you'd made so far?
No, actually, it's pretty low budget.
Oh, right, really? The trailer looks big to me. Like,
oh, thank you.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
I watched it just today, and I was like, oh, that looks like a big movie.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a studio movie.
Yeah.
And so you have all that studio overhead, and then it wasn't a very big budget because, you know, they're testing. Why? I don't know why. It's like...
Yeah.
Why does this keep happening? Why do I get movies that are in trouble and need saving?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't get any more budget. I don't know. But that's the story for me.
Maybe I'll get the sequel.
But there's a lot of material that you've written over the years that I assume you still want to tackle that you've been developing since before this Nancy Drew one.
Well, you know, I had this novel I wrote, and I feel like it would be pretty interesting to do. So we'll see if that – maybe I'll do that. But I would be very happy to keep doing the Nancy movies too.
Yeah.
You know, because we put together such a great cast that go into the next movies. And I love the writers. It's Nina Fior and John Herrera who are in Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
And they've done a lot of other stuff and they're really good. And, you know, we're just working with Jeff again – be amazing, Jeff and Chip. So,
wow.
So when people show you, like, so a friend of our show, Phil Blankenship, is, you know, it's his passion project to show your three films in reverse chronological order in 35 mil. And I'm still curious about that. I think that'll be interesting because you're going to be bringing in with
I think that's the way, because I think, here's the thing. I want to watch Ship to Kill at like 11 p.m.
Yeah.
Like that needs to be my midnight movie.
Wait till the wusses clear out and then hit them with Ship to Kill.
It's going to be so much fun to see it that way.
But
here's the thing. I did get better as a director. So we're going in reverse order. So you're going to see Poison Ivy and then you're going to see me get a little bit worse and a little bit worse. but
which means that you shouldn't get to allowed to talk until the very end. So you have to come in at the very end of your first movie.
Are you coming in? Are you?
No, I'm just going to come in after Poison Ivy, and talk a little bit, and then I'm leaving.
Yeah,
all right.
So that's what I was going to say. Yeah, I imagine you can't watch them, and you probably have a different.
Him and I are staying at the bitter end.
I will be there on a Tuesday night on a school night. I will still be there watching Strip to Kill. God knows what time for you.
I appreciate.
But really, it's for me, not you. It's for me.
Well, I saw them 500 times, and it's just...
Have you seen them in the last few years? I'm always curious how, because you've changed so much, when you look back at it, is it just like an artifact, or do you still hit the making button? Like, you're like, I remember doing that. I remember the people behind the scenes. And
well, I went to the Fanispoa in Brazil Film Festival, and they gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award. It was okay, well, now it's really over. and they showed Strip to Kill and then Poison Ivy. And there's such a big difference, you know. I mean, you grow and everybody else grew too, so.
But you're not alone. Look at Sam Raimi. Look at Evil Dead, made for nothing versus, Spider-Man. So this is the natural flow.
Yeah, this is the natural flow. Yeah. So I actually sat through Strip to Kill. And, it's hard for me to do because, Roger did chop it up quite a bit. And there's a lot of very abrupt cuts in it. So it's a little hard for me to watch because I was so passionate about it, and wrote it and researched it. And, I went to all those strip clubs. I found all those strippers, you know what I mean? Like, I did all that stuff and I was so passionate about it. And to see it kind of, it really got battered. So it's hard for me to watch it because of that.
There's never any talk of trying to do a reconstruction from back in the day here. He wouldn't have that footage.
I don't know if they do or not.
Yeah.
I actually don't know. But that would be lovely because it could be so much more elegant, and then Poison Ivy, actually, I kind of enjoy watching it.
Yeah.
I just
– It's slick. It's really well made, yeah.
It's so poetic, though, the way that it's shot and the way that it was written and everything. I feel like I accomplished a lot of what I wanted to in Poison Ivy. And in Nancy Drew – I accomplished even more of what I wanted to. So that's amazing.
Wow. Well, I think it's a pretty good story of not quitting. I mean, you've got these periods where I think a lot of people would just quit and you just kept going. And, 17 years, you wouldn't think you'd get to make that kind of a movie, and you did. So that's awesome. Yeah.
Well, I was teaching in between, you know. I mean, I work with actors all the time. So, it kept me really in the game because, I'm working with actors all the time. I'm putting people on camera. I'm watching the actors that I work with become really successful. Mm-hmm. So I think that is what really – I think that's the reason, I could just jump in after all that time and go.
Yeah.
Oh, here's the really cool thing. So, I do this work with actors, and I have them do these really crazy exercises, really get them out of their head so that they're really free and spontaneous and all this stuff. And for the first time in my whole directing career, I actually used that with the actors. And I had been doing that a long time ago. Actually, I did do it on Strip to Kill with some of the people that weren't real actors. But I did it on Nancy Drew with really experienced actors, and it was taking their performances to a whole different level. And so that just – I don't know. It just made it so much fun because here I'm using these techniques that I've been teaching with, and they were working on this movie, and – everybody was loving it. Like, all these actors. Now they tell me they never do an audition or they never work without doing the stuff that we did.
Yeah.
So that was really kind of gratifying.
Yeah, that's cool. Is that going to be a summer movie or do you know when?
It's March 15th.
So it's pretty soon. March
15th. Yeah, it's really soon.
And I mean, part of this also is obviously if you're in Los Angeles, you should come to the New Beverly.
Oh, yeah.
But
say hi.
The thing that's great about our listeners is they're very passionate and we encourage them, even if you're not in the state, to do this triple feature.
Yeah, you have enough time to get on Amazon to order some of these.
Well, Strip to Kill is on Amazon Prime.
Uh-huh, okay.
I have the Scorpion Blu-ray, which I think is out of print now, but you can watch it on Amazon Prime, so definitely watch that. Streets is on DVD with Angel in Red. It's a double feature, a Corman double feature that Shout Factory put out. And Scream Factory is putting out Poison Ivy on February 12th on Blu-ray,
okay,
which is
cool.
Kind of insane.
That's nice.
You did a new commentary for it, apparently. Yeah,
I did do a commentary for it.
Yeah. So you can watch along at home. Otherwise, join me and Elric at the movies.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be
and
good.
And
if you're looking
minutes.
For an acting class, they should look me up.
Oh, where are you?
Okay, yeah, yeah. Let's talk about that. Yeah. CatShay.com.
So you teach independently. You don't teach for a school. You just are your own.
Yeah, I teach answering. Independently.
Cool.
Yeah.
How many students do you usually work with at a time?
Well, if it's in class, it's only like 12. Mm-hmm. I keep it really small so that, you know, everybody's working all the time. And then I do private sessions and I coach them for auditions and stuff like that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you get to, you know, another shot at directing. I like the through line of yours, but I don't like the amount of time you have to wait. So
yeah.
So let's hope that part changes.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Congrats. Yeah. That's really cool. And
Thanks
for
you.
Doing this. It's a blast, and I'm excited to now we're going to have you back just to talk about Streets, but maybe we'll just pick your brain after we see it.
There'll be an
Streets
email with
an interesting story. Yeah.
There's going to be. Well, actually, you know what? One quick question before we wrap up. And maybe it was on your podcast when you were talking about Streets, but something you keep talking about that I find fascinating is the writing process. You were saying, like, for Strip to Kill, you went to strip joints, and I thought that someone had told me for Streets that you did spend a lot of time with homeless youth.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these aren't the average things that a writer really...
I was living in the street in Venice.
Really?
To research Streets.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I was married at the time, and probably about midnight, my husband would come cruise by and get me. You know what I mean? So I wasn't actually sleeping there all the time. But, you know, I knew all the street people. I was a street person. Mm-hmm. As far as they were concerned, I was living on the streets, too.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, they're all based – everybody in the movie is based on a real person, you know? The names have been changed. But,
yeah. So when it comes to the writing process, you go the full –
Well,
9 yards.
Yeah, probably. It's, you know, I don't know. I didn't, you know, but I don't know how good that is. I mean, I had Dawn, you know, at the house a few times, like the real Dawn, who was shooting up in the bathroom and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I learned a lot.
Did she, do you think she survived that world or do you?
I don't know. You
hard,
know, I mean, you know, it's hard
too
because I try to save everybody, you know, it's like I was putting homeless people in apartments and stuff. So, I don't think that lasted too long.
Yeah.
So I also learned about saving people doesn't really work and, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think to write, you really have to know what you're writing about. It's got to be truth. And, you know, I just can't make it up.
Hmm.
You can't make it up. So I went and found out.
Wow. Pretty intense.
Some heavy shit.
I will think about that when I watch these movies.
It is. But, you know, Venice has become much more – the homelessness has expanded quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's questionable outside the front of this.
Oh, building. Where we are, yeah, for sure.
Kind of a bad area. But anyways.
Yeah.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. And
oh, thank
we're excited
you.
To see
Thanks
your
so much for
again.
Having me. And I'm so I'm so honored that Phil has
I think they're his prints, too. So I think he actually owns
them,
these prints.
Seriously?
Yeah, no, I think he does.
Where
I think all three of them.
Oh,
he's a print collector, but I think those he's a fan, obviously. So
yeah,
that's beautiful.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah we're really looking forward to it. And we're glad you come down, and we hope that people listening to this will celebrate along with us and watch these films as well.
Awesome.
And then maybe add Carrie 2 afterwards. Like we won't get to see it, but
I like Carrie 2 a lot.
We'll do it after.
Carrie 2 has actually aged very well because, you know, I mean, somebody told me that it's like the anthem movie for Me Too movement. So, and I
the
could
whole bullying
see that.
Thing.
You know, first when I heard that, I went, what? And I went, oh no, that's really appropriate.
Yeah. Plus the cool tattoo thing. I love that.
Yeah. It's amazing how many people, fans, actually get these tattoos.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like from Poison Ivy, it's like people show me their tattoo. It's just like Poison Ivy or The Rage.
Yeah.
They have the Ivy tattoo. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
That's
pretty incredible. Yeah, not us. So we're too old to get tattooed based on.
Well, not the other our co-hosts are constantly
Ryan
doing
maybe.
It.
They're a different story. But.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kat. We appreciate it. And we'll see you guys at the New Bev on Tuesday.
Yes.
And again, the new Nancy Drew movie opens March 15th. So
yeah,
we'll definitely check
that
out.
You can take your 7-year-old or 5-year-old to it.
Becca, you can take your kids.
Yes. It's the hidden staircase.
You can. It's got a little bit of scariness in it. But I don't think it's going to scar anybody. If you met Becca,
it's totally fine. Her kids
plus,
are
at 8, I saw like The Shining. So I think they'll be okay at 7 watching The Staircase.
Yeah, they won't be scarred.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Excellent. Great. Cool. Thanks so much. Okay. And we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.